Yeah, so thank you for the kind introduction. I'm going to present the work with the title LogDoc, a trace-based analysis of logging in the Linux kernel. This is a joint work done by Olaf Spinzig, Hendrik Borkhorst, Horst Schirmeier, and of course myself. So let's imagine you come up with a great, awesome idea to improve the file system subsystem in the Linux kernel. So, and when you're going to implement that, you will at least face two things. One, you have to, most certainly will have to deal with some sort of synchronization. And second, you will definitely handle the struct inode, which is one of the central data types in the file system part of the Linux kernel. So what you, so where do you get the information about locking and the struct inode? The first good starting point for that is actually the definition where the struct inode is defined, as you can see on the right-hand side of the slide. So let's start reading. By the way, that struct has about 50 elements in it. So when you start reading, you will encounter the so-called ilog, which is basically a spin log, as you can see on the bottom of the slide. And there is a small comment. And let's say, guessing from the context, it seems that the ilog is responsible for synchronizing the access to iblocks, ibytes, and yeah, maybe isize. So let's say it is responsible for 2.5 members of the struct inode. And if you keep reading, you will encounter another log that is embedded in an inode. And here it is a read-write semaphore. But here you cannot find any comment at all. So after reading the definition of the struct inode, we were basically stuck at that little piece of information about locking in the struct inode. So what will you do next? So the only thing you can do is you start digging furthermore into the kernel code. And another good thing to start is the so-called inode.c. You can see just 50% of that large file on the left-hand side of the slide. And right at the very beginning of that file is a more or less huge block about comments, about locking, sorry. And there it says the ilog embedded in an inode protects. Wow, that's pretty precise syntax. But wait a second, a few lines later, there it says inode liu list logs protect. Honestly, I have an idea, but I do not know for sure which log is meant by that comment. And if you keep reading, at the very bottom you can see iunique log. That's not an actual member of the inode. It's just a meta name for another log. I have an idea too, but you cannot tell it for sure. So if you keep digging, we'll find the find inode function. And there it says at the beginning of that function, called with the inode log held. Yeah, again, I have an idea which log is meant here, but it's not precise. It's just a normal prose sentence. Okay, we have a little bit more information, but let's keep digging. You will find the inode set flags function, and there you find a larger block about locking, but just wait a few seconds. There it says, the caller should be holding imutex, which first doesn't exist anymore, by the way. That element has been deleted, I think, 2 years ago. And furthermore, it says the reason for the compare exchange loop in that function, which wouldn't be necessary if all code paths which modify iflags actually follow this rule, is that there is at least one code path which doesn't today. So we use compare exchange out of an abundance of caution. So who of you is still using an Android smartphone right now? Actually, I do, but yeah. So to sum it up, the documentation of locking rules in a Linux kernel is, as you've seen, scattered throughout the whole code. And we are talking about thousands of lines. I mean, even the inode C has about 3,000 lines of code. And the syntax, or the comments that are present, are not well defined, and some descriptions are ambiguous or even conflicting. So this induces a huge potential for programming errors that could lead to inefficiencies, deadlocks, crashes, or even the worst silent data corruptions. So this is the point where Lockdog kicks in. We basically assume that locking is done mostly correct in the observed system, which is the Linux kernel here. Otherwise, the Linux kernel would not have been so popular over the last decades. And in our approach, we observe the operating system record a trace. From that trace, we infer locking rules. And based on those rules, we can pinpoint potential locking bugs, so code locations that do not adhere to the aforementioned inferred locking rules. So I will first talk about our approach in general, and then how we applied that approach to Linux, and conclude with our results that we found. So let's shrink our world a little bit and say we have a simple toy operating system with a toy example, which is basically a system clock that counts seconds and minutes. And we have one code location A that does that for us, as you can see on the left-hand side on the slide. So basically, we acquire the sec lock, increments the seconds, and if seconds reach 60, we acquire another lock that protects the minutes variable, increment minutes, and release both locks afterwards. However, we have another code location B that does more or less the same, with the exception that the min lock is missing. So this is an actual bug. In our little toy environment, we're gonna run the code at location A for 1,000 times and the code at location B just once. So lines 5 and 6 of the source code you can see on the slide is basically run 17 times. So what we're gonna do is we record variable accesses and lock operations. And we can bind them by using the concept of what we call a transaction. A transaction is a sequence of accesses with a fixed set of locks that are currently being held. So for example, in this code, transaction A is started in line 1 with the acquisition of the sec lock. And all subsequent accesses are associated to that transaction. And another transaction B is started in line 4. And again, the subsequent accesses are assigned to transaction B. And transaction B, of course, has both locks associated with it, and transaction A just the sec lock. And just a little addition here. So how do we count variable accesses? So again, we have the code from location A, which does the locking right. And of course, we distinguish between each single variable. But furthermore, we distinguish between read and write accesses. So you can see here, for example, that the seconds variable is read 2 times in transaction A, and the minutes variable is written once in transaction B. But we do not know whether these two observations for you, for example, come from a code location where the locking is done right. So what we do is we, let's say, compress our data to a binary information, whether there was an access or not. The actual count doesn't matter here. We compress our data furthermore, because we can, when we have a transaction where a variable is written and read at the same, not at the same, but in the same transaction, we can ignore the read access at this point, because we can safely assume when writing a variable, a more restrictive locking policy is necessary than when reading a variable. So for our calculations, we use the last column where it says WOR, basically write over read. So with that counting, I will now come to how we get to our locking rules. For the next two slides, I will just focus on writing to the minutes variable. So we basically create all possible lock combinations, which are just 4 in this case, because we just have 2 locks, obviously. And each hypothesis is annotated with the absolute support, which is the number of observations with logs being held. So for example, here, rule number one, we have 17 observations with the sec log. And there's also the relative support, which is basically the percentage. And from that list of hypotheses, we select the hypotheses with the highest relative support that is above the acceptance threshold of here 90%, with one exception. If we encounter more than 5% of excesses without any log being held, we will conclude that there is no log needed at all. So in this case, we would select hypothesis number one. So let's recall our code, a little toy example. And there it says we actually have two logs that are necessary to write to the minutes variable, as you can see in line 6. So this naive approach, selecting the hypothesis with the highest relative support, obviously does not work. So what we did, we removed the exceptional case about no logs being held and added, you can see on the in the gray table, we now have a, let's call it, backup hypothesis, which always has a relative support of 100%, because no logs means we have an empty set of logs, and that's obviously true for every memory access you see in your system. And from that list of hypotheses, we select the first hypothesis with that it has a relative support above 90%. So in this case, we have actually two, number two and number three, because both have 94.12%. Since we both have the same relative support, we select the hypothesis with more logs involved, which is here rule number two, and this actually corresponds to the code we've seen in the introduction. So how did we apply logdoc on Linux? So first of all, we run an FS-targeted subset from the Linux test project in a emulator and record memory accesses and log operations using the failstar framework. And then we then transfer the data into a relational database. Just one side note here, we filter out memory accesses that happen during initialization and deconstruction of memory accesses because there might not be any logs needed. We then use that relational database to generate hypotheses for each element of a struct, again, separately for read and write accesses. And from those lists, we select one winning hypothesis for each element of a struct, again, for read and write accesses. We finally then use our results to check the existing logging documentation, find potential logging bugs, and we can then update the central documentation of logging rules. So how does that look like? Here we checked the existing documentation of the Linux kernel. We examined 5 central documented data types, and there were actually 71 elements documented. Since we distinguish between read and write, we have 142 documented logging rules. And from all of them, we observed 81% in our data set, and that can have two reasons. A, our workload does currently not cover all code paths in a Linux kernel, or B, some elements are just read-only, so we do not see a write to that element at all. And only 53% of all observed logging rules have a relative support of 100%. That could mean that A, the documentation is not up to date, which is definitely the case. And second, that's very interesting, some file systems allow deviant logging rules. And yeah, that's another interesting point here. And we also did some mining for 11 different data types and generate locking rules, and with those locking rules, we, for example, can generate updated documentation. For example, as you've seen it in the introduction, this is an actual update. So if you look below the black part, there it says the IRWSEM, which is the read-write semaphore you've seen in the introduction, embedded in the same inode we are currently accessing, that's meant by embedded same. That one protects, for example, the iFlags, IUID or IGID. And finally, for those locking rules that have a relative support below 100%, we can pinpoint locking bugs. For example, if you want to write to the iHash object of an inode, we concluded that first, the inode hash log is needed, and second, the iLog embedded in the same inode we are currently accessing. However, we observed an access, in write access of course, that hold the inode hash log, but used an iLog that was embedded in another inode that we are currently not accessing. And for that, of course for all bugs, we can pinpoint the precise code location, including these stack traces that led to that code location. Yeah, actually, due to, let's call it, some peculiarities of the Linux kernel, we have a huge list of bugs at the moment. And this still requires some manual inspection by the kernel developers. And yeah, however, we have already one confirmed documentation bug, which we found during our pre-processing, and one synchronization bug that we found using Logdoc. So to sum it up, Logdoc is a generic approach for log analysis in complex software system, like, for example, operating system and Linux. And we can use it to check existing logging documentation. We can generate new and consistent documentation. And, of course, find and locate potential logging bugs. And for Logdoc on Linux, we have, right at the moment, two confirmed bugs, one merged commit, and three currently pending commits. You're still waiting for the answer by the author, by the kernel maintainers. And for the future, we are planning to bring Logdoc to FreeBSD, which is currently work in progress. And yeah, of course, talk to the kernel developers to refine our results. And we want to use the syscaller framework to improve our code coverage for our benchmarks. And yeah, thank you very much for your attention. And I would be glad to answer any questions here or later in the poster session. Just search for the little talks you can see up here, that paramedic one. Thank you.
Thanks. We have time for some questions.
Tom Anderson from UW, can you compare the inference mechanism to what we did in Eraser?
I didn't get the first.
Can you compare the approach you took for inferring lock behavior with, say, earlier systems like Eraser or other systems that were trying to infer lock behavior? Now, they were operating in application code, so it wasn't Linux kernel, but did essentially attempt to try to do the same thing.
Yeah. There was that paper. I forgot the author, but the title was Bugs as Deviant Behavior.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a number.
Yeah, a number. And they basically do static code analysis. And when doing that, you have some sort of issues like the alias problem. And since the Linux kernel does use a huge number of pointers, like for function and virtual tables and stuff like that, it's actually hard to like infer those locking rules with static code analysis.
So Eraser was dynamic. So again, it wasn't doing it in the kernel because it wasn't. It was doing it for user code, but was doing dynamic lock analysis.
I have to confess. Anyway, I know the paper. I think we cited it and I read it, but I honestly forgot the content. Sorry.
We can follow up later.
No, sorry.
Okay.
Hey, Kaimas Cornell University. I'm curious how many of the 50,000 problems you found you think are false positives? roughly? Maybe you don't know.
Honestly, I think 80%. The problem is that I summarized it with some peculiarities of the Linux kernel. We had a close discussion with one of the kernel developers, and we sent them our bug reports and say, hey, we have a bunch of bugs here. Can you please comment on that? And for a few things, he just said, yeah, that's basically right, but in that case, there is no concurrent access to that variable, so you do not need any log at all. Or, yeah, for that file system, generally speaking, that rule is correct, but for that particular file system, there is no log needed at all because there is no current access. And there are some of them.
I mean, that still sounds like a documentation bug to me, honestly, but yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, cool work.
Actually a lot of like common SWAM knowledge in the Linux kernel that is not written anymore. And the kernel developer also think that no log is needed if you read or write a 32-bit variable because it's always atomic on every supported architecture. And of course, if you do not very concerned about consistency, yes, for sure. But that rule is not documented anywhere.
All right, let's thank the speaker again.